Welcome. I'm Kevin Miller, and this podcast is called Self-Helpful, because not all self-help is helpful. I'm your curator, critic, and translator of the best and brightest minds in the self-help world today. The authentic you and how to discover it for the first time. Being authentic is a huge buzzword in our culture today. We want authenticity from others. We actually demand it, and we want to claim our own authenticity. Yet you're about to be schooled in a stark yet hopeful reality, and it starts with understanding and accepting that nobody comes into adulthood being authentically who they are, and discovering your true authenticity is a big undertaking. The hope in this is in realizing that most of your personal struggles in your relationship with yourself, with others, even the world, can only get better from this point as you start stepping more fully into your authentic self. Two big points you're about to hear. You come into this world with an already installed operating system. It's based on your genetics, further programmed and hardwired in during your upbringing. So you leave home with a solid OS. You don't wake up on your own one day in your first apartment or dorm room or wherever it may be, and you're just free and authentic. That's realization number one. Next, two, from the moment you come into this world, your natural desire is to attach to others. And this is far more important than being the authentic you, to the point you never really experience the authentic you. Right now, whether you're a Navy SEAL, an executive, a stay-at-home parent, a student, you have spent your entire life with the priority of belonging and being attached to others, far superseding being who you really are. And it's diminished your entire life. My guest, expert, and guide on the subject is Vienna Farren. Her new book is called The Origins of You, How Breaking Family Patterns Can Liberate the Way We Live and Love. And I don't want anybody getting caught up in that breaking family patterns and thinking, oh, no, I got to go just diss my upbringing. You know, it was pretty great all in all. We really hit on that because that's how I feel as well. And yet no parents are perfect. No caregivers are perfect. There's no way that they can have raised you perfectly. And as you'll hear in this, we start talking about ourselves as well. Me as a father of nine, I'm owning and accepting what I have and haven't given to my own kids. Vienna has been posting her insights driven from thousands of patient encounters on Instagram. She has nearly 700,000 followers tuning in to find their authentic selves. Vienna Farren, she's a licensed marriage and family therapist, one of New York City's most sought after relationship therapists. She's practiced therapy for over 15 years and is founder and owner of the group practice Mindful Marriage and Family Therapy. Vienna has been featured in The Economist, Netflix, Vice, and Motherly, and has led workshops for Peloton and Netflix, amongst others. The Origins of You is her first book and is endorsed by renowned therapists such as Nedra Glover-Tawab and Whitney Goodman, who I've had on the show as well. And as of this recording, The Origins of You is at the top of the charts in Amazon. Friends, thanks for tuning in. The Self-Helpful Podcast was founded through the Zig Ziglar Corporation. And if you are a coach or consultant and want to add credibility and clients and impact to your business, go visit Ziglar.com today. This podcast exists to help you find and understand the guidance and counsel that will help you elevate your personal experience of life and the way you show up for others. Following these sponsors who help make the show possible and provide great resources for your life, I bring you therapist Vienna Farren and the message from her book, The Origins of You, and a profound look at the authentic you you want to become. You can find Vienna at viennafarren.com. Let me spell that for you, though. viennapharaon.com. I'm a foodie and I enjoy learning about the process that brings great foods and beverages from idea to the table. And then I like tasting them and learning the nuances of what creates the most significant tastes from coffee to cheese to distilled beverages. I did a tequila tasting in Mexico and recently bourbon, Heaven Hill Bottled in Bond Bourbon, really impressed me from the story to the taste. I grew up in Kentucky where horse racing and bourbon are famous, and I got introduced to Heaven Hill
bottled in bond bourbon. It's produced by Heaven Hill Distillery, which has been and still remains family-owned since 1935. And I'm impressed with the bourbon's ultra-rich, smooth taste. And right on the bottle, it states that this bourbon is 7 years old, which is actually three times longer than what's required to be certified as bottled in bond. I feel with beverages, the longer the prep, the better the taste. Being a bottled in bond product means it must pass a list of seven requirements that set the standard for this quality bourbon. So look for it at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely and drink wisely.
Vienna, as I talked about, when I saw that Nedra Tawab and Whitney Goodman were recommending your book, you had my interest and, you know, the origins of you. And right away when I got into it, what really came up was, I think we all know that we're influenced by our upbringing. That's not new news, but the gravity that you have given to it even went beyond. I've been saying a lot of times, no, that's our programming. Mm-hmm. And in reading just right away at the beginning of the book, I felt like, no, you're really showcasing, no, this is your operating system. And it kind of gave me a different perspective. And I found myself talking to my kids even about it, going, guys, for better or worse, you have my operating system, you know, myself and your mom, and that's it. We got ours from here. That's what you got. And we're minimizing it. And I think that's what gravity is, the kind of word that came to me, that you have increased the gravity of saying, no, guys, this is it. This is the big deal. You don't just wake up and go to something different and forget about this stuff. It is who you are. And I think that's pretty weighty, I think, for most people to conceptualize and to actually accept.
Yeah, I think it is challenging. It was hard for me, you know, for a really long time. I ignored it and found ways to distract myself from it. Quick little blurb about my story is that my parents went through a 9-year divorce process that started when I was in first grade. And there was so much during that time and for all the years after of intense conflict, psychological abuse, manipulation, gaslighting, paranoia, emotional flooding, just all of it. And there, it was very uncomfortable and very traumatizing and very hard. And for decades, I sat with my parents' divorce didn't affect me. They're good friends now, which was true. Right? That was accurate. At a certain point, they would travel to my lacrosse games in college together. They'd come to my recitals. We'd have holidays together. And so it was much more palatable for me to say that everything was fine. And I was a totally normal, healthy child, and it didn't have any type of effect on me. And I kept that narrative with me even into the beginning of graduate school. And I get a real kick out of it now. I'm like, oh my gosh, my professors and advisors, supervisors must have just been like, oh, sweet girl. Here you are trying to get into the field of marriage and family therapy, and you don't think that your past had any impact on you. And I understood that later. It was really overwhelming. To be with pain was overwhelming. And to understand a little bit more about my story, while my parents were in the chaos, the role that I took on as an only child in a system that was, you know, crashing and burning around me was to become the okay one. I'm fine. I'm unaffected. I'm unbothered. I'm all good over here. My thought process at the time was, you guys are so unwell that there's no room for me to not be okay. And I had maintained that role for a really long time. And so this idea of coming into contact with me actually not being okay, with me actually being affected, was so new, right? And so just to your point, there's a lot of things that get in the way of us being able to really be in contact with the pain and the experiences and the story. High level, where you started was, we all know, of course, that our childhood plays like some kind of role, but then we just kind of move on and we're like, nah, I don't want to, that was so long ago. That was decades ago.
That's what got to me as I was reading your book and thinking about this, that what is it about us To me, I'm going to use the word ignorance, which I like that word. It doesn't mean dumb. It's just lacking knowledge that we grow up, you know, at some point we kind of get to the point generally of going, okay, I'm ready to go. And we take off and all of a sudden we're in college or a job or whatever. And we wake up and we're in our own place. We are our own person. We want to think that we're our own person. And now we can just do what we want to. It's kind of a clean slate and realizing, holy smokes, it reminds me of the old, I thought of in reading the book, the old school, I know this is sexist and terrible, but finishing school for girls, you know, kind of thing. And I'm thinking, and we need one of those for all of us, that we get out of high school, let's say, and somebody like a you, like a therapist goes, okay, what do we got here? Let's figure this out and unpack this and see what we're starting with, because you got a whole operating system. Let's get you fully aware of that and figure out what we need to, you know, break you of, reprogram you of. What was great that you can leverage and expound on as well. But that's what gave me the, it got me feeling like with my own kids, I want to go, guys, we need to have a family meeting. You guys have been brainwashed. I feel like that's a big word, but it really feels like that. For you to be really clear and clean and figure out as best you can, figure out who you are, you almost need a, I don't know, what would you say? A reboot, or I almost felt like a re-brainwash, figure out who and what you want to be.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think there's the space, the freedom to actually have your own thoughts and opinions and feelings. You know, it's like our family systems are the first place where we get an education on just about everything. And we're told what to think and what to do and what to believe. And for many people, that programming and conditioning just comes along with us. There's never a point where we're like, wait a second, do I actually believe that? Or what do I actually think about this? Because we grow up in environments and systems where things are explicitly stated or implicitly implied, right? And we receive it as truth, as anyone does when you're a kiddo, right? Of course we do. And so, yeah, this idea of, okay, when do I get to question? Because not everything that was given to me is wrong, bad, misaligned, whatever you want to call it, right? Much of it is probably lovely and wonderful and supportive. And then there are also things that are misaligned and keep us stuck in the unwanted patterns that we have in our adult lives. I think unwanted patterns that we can't shake today as adults is a really big indicator. I say the unwanted patterns in our lives today that we can't just change. If you can change it, great. You want to imply employ a behavioral shift and you're able to do that, amazing. But if you keep coming back into an unwanted pattern, right, that is tied to your resolution in your past.
That is what really brought me to finally not just say, man, everything was great. I have no reason to have anything negative. I had a very relative, and we'll talk, I want to talk about this in a second, but a relatively, you know, untraumatic, small t, you know, childhood. It seemed pretty great, but, and I'm grateful that you said that a minute ago. It may have been a lovely, wonderful, supportive, you know, seeming home. But at the best, at the very best, it was dramatically limited. That's what gets me now. I mean, my kids are so limited by their influence, primarily by their mom and dad. And, you know, we used to have ages ago, many ages ago, you know, we grew up in community, in a village, and it takes a village to raise somebody. And you had aunts and uncles and extended family and friends, and we were all there, kind of the big fat Greek wedding type idea, which I really like a lot of that. And now we're so isolated that my kids' experience is so limited. And even if I am doing my very best, I just can't expose them to everything. It gets me even, well, let's stop there, because then the patterns that they embrace and engage and continue. And if they're not aware of, especially those negative things, because there just has to be, I can't be a perfect parent.
Exactly. Right. We exist in an imperfect system, and that's, you know, we have so many ways in which we distract ourselves from. People are afraid of opening a Pandora's box and what will I find, or will it be too much, or will it be too overwhelming? Or maybe I have a relationship with my family now that I think is okay and good, and I worked really hard for that, and I don't want to go there and disrupt it. Or maybe I have a deceased parent, and if I find something and I can't have a conversation with them and there can't be any type of reconciliation, I'm afraid about that. Or the narrative that we hear, you know, often, you know, they did the best that they could with what they had, or, well, their parents were so much worse than they were to me. So like, obviously they're on the right path. You know, it's like we have all of these explanations and reasons and fears, and, you know, all of that can be valid and true. And it is a distraction away from honoring our pain. Right? It's a distraction away from just being with what our experience is. And like you said, at the very minimum, even when we have phenomenal parents, there is an imperfect system that we are navigating. This work, The Origins of You, is not meant to throw parents under the bus. This isn't us going on a wild goose chase. This isn't us trying to point fingers or blame or stay in a victim position. This is about identifying and addressing what is true, right? And honoring that so that we can move forward, so that we can have an inner peace, so that the life and the relationships that we say we want to have actually have an opportunity to shift, right? Because the past comes with us in the obvious ways many of us maybe know, but it also comes with us in really subtle ways as well. And if we're not tending to the original pain and wounding, as I put it in my book, it's going to keep running the show.
I want to go right there. It's actually, it's page 37 of your book, revealing, revealing the wound. So talk about pain, because Vienna, I just had never related to that word. If you told me, asked me about trauma or pain, I'd go, gosh, man, it was I used to remember, literally say, and this is going to date my age, it was the Beaver Cleaver family, man. Everything was kind of good. And I won't name names, but I've had people in my life who have had pretty significant, acute, blatant trauma. And I've since then come to feel like sometimes I wonder if what you just talked about, the subtle trauma, is even worse, because we tend to discount it. But I did want to ask you about that, those two words, trauma and pain. So a lot of people like myself are just, they don't tune into those words. And I would say, I would skew it worse on the man side, on men's side of not coming to those words. So I started working through that after page 37 in your book. Okay, what are some other ways that I might feel that word or resonate with that? And I thought, how about that moment of anger, to think back as a kid, a moment of, man, I was really angry. Maybe I lashed out, frustration, something that felt really unfair. And I'm opening up some of my own Pandora's boxes, some things that happened. And it wasn't all from my parents. It was from other people as well, which you talk about too. A moment of being scared, a significant fear, and it got me thinking back about, I joke about it with my kids, but I was dramatically scared of the dark. I don't really know where that came from, and I don't know really where it ended. It didn't continue. I don't sleep under the covers, and I'm not scared to walk out in the dark today, but it was terrifying. And so to think back that, so I wanted people to hear that when you say pain and trauma, to think about, is that fair? Anger, frustration, unfairness, scared, fears, or something else that we should add there? That because I hear you say, no, everybody, that exists to everybody to some degree.
Yeah, I would say that everyone has some type of origin wounding. And the reason why I use, and yeah, trauma, pain, wounds, the reason I use the word wound is because I think when we hear that word, we think of the physical. Everybody knows what a physical wound is, right? It's like, and especially when we're kids, right? We scrape our knee, somebody cleans it, they wash it out, they put a Band-Aid over it, let it get some air underneath it, tell you that's the best way to heal it. Then we take the Band-Aid off, there's a scab. And then of course, inevitably as kids, we bang it up against the chair and the scab falls off and it starts to bleed again. Okay, that visual representation is something that we all understand. That's the same thing with emotional and psychological wounds, right? Is that there is an original moment in which there is the anger, the reactivity, everything that you're describing in the book, right? I would say these moments where we don't feel worthy, where we don't feel good enough, where there's conditions for love. If I get straight A's, if I score the hat trick, if I am perfect, right? That's when I get love, connection, attention, validation, approval, peace, calm from the important people in my life. It's when we don't feel like we are a part of the family, we're the outsider, we don't fit in, we're the black sheep. It's when we don't feel important enough to the people who mean the most to us because they're prioritizing work over us, or they're prioritizing conflict, or they're prioritizing going on endless dates with new people because they're so focused on that, that they forget about what your experience is and what it is that you need. Right. It's when we don't feel like we can trust because there's a betrayal or deceit or lies that are happening in our family, or when we just don't feel like our overall well-being is being considered, honored, respected, or protected. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so it's like these things can, yes, of course, happen in these big ways. We know that, you know, I think to your point, you have friends who have big stories. And what you're describing, I don't know what page it is on in the book, but what I talk about, wound comparison, yes. Right? Where it's like, okay, well, how dare I even complain about this little thing over here when my buddy over here was sexually abused, when my other friend over here had, you know, a parent who abandoned them. You know, it's like my stuff doesn't even compare to that. And those are all things that are distractions away from honoring our own story. When we do that, right? When we do that, we walk away from exactly what it is that we need to.
I live high up in the Rocky Mountains where the air is clean and fresh as possible, but then I step indoors and I'm breathing in untold amounts of toxins and allergens from paint and carpet and cleaning chemicals and pets and furniture and appliances and mold and so on. Studies show the indoor air is 2 to 5 times more polluted than the outdoor air anywhere you are. And in some places, it's 100 times worse than that. Well, the solution is to get an air purifier, and Air Doctor is just the best out there. It filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants and allergens, such as pollen and pet dander and dust mites and mold and even bacteria and viruses, so your lungs don't have to try to do that. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Go to airdoctorpro.com. You can use the promo code Kevin, and depending on the model, you'll receive up to 39% off or up to $300. Exclusive to podcast customers, you will also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. So to get the special deal, go to airdoctorpro.com. Use promo code Kevin. Thankfully, the days of building a business website, then having this massive endeavor to integrate an online store are gone. Today, Shopify has fixed all that. I had one business where we actually built the entire website on Shopify's platform. So whether you're just starting out or you're selling $1 million of product already, Shopify is just the industry leader. It works the same for physical products or online and digital, and Shopify is just hands down the best out there. Most importantly, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It's 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Getting people to buy is not that hard, at least to the buying point, but getting them to actually give their payment info is, and Shopify is king in that department. They also have top tier customer service, which I think is critical. You can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Kevin. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Kevin to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Kevin.
It makes me think, as you're saying that, that as I look and compare, maybe there's even room to say, man, I am grateful that that didn't happen to me. That is really, really harsh. And yet not to invalidate. And in reading that section on wound, you also got me to thinking, and as I was thinking about my own childhood, some things where I look back and, I mean, my parents are not faultless, but there are some things that I look at and go, you know, I don't know if there's anything that they really did do wrong in that instance. I, however, might have had an adverse reaction based on whatever, something that a friend put in my head, or some perspective that I got, or I was just being a little butt, whatever it was. And I, but either way, I felt bad. So something happened. It was pretty benign. It could have been, everybody would have looked and gone, what? But for some reason I took it bad. And regardless of what I hear you're saying, is regardless, a wound is a wound is a wound is a wound.
If it is
a wound is, yeah, that's it.
If it
a wound is a wound is a wound. And I think, you know, there's a story that I share in the prioritization chapter about a client who I call Andre. And he talked about how he has a single mom who is working multiple jobs. Yeah. She'd work doubles every day, except for Sundays. They would go to church together Sunday morning, and then they'd have brunch together afterwards growing up. And he loved and respected his mother so much. It was, you know, he wanted to protect her so much, and he could really rationalize that her working these double shifts was her way of prioritizing him. He understood that, right. But it didn't move him away from what the desire to be prioritized by her through time spent.
Gosh,
this is a
neglect. I mean, there's no way he could not, to some degree, have been a little more neglected because she was kicking butt to take care of him. But still, what you're saying, it still exists. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the heart rate. It's like to get to that place to say, I wanted to be prioritized more through time spent, period. We don't have to throw mama under the bus. We don't have to talk badly about her. We can honor and respect and still love and also still say that you did not have the experience of feeling prioritized in the way that you wanted to.
Yeah.
Period. Right. And that's, you know, it makes sense then as adults, right? He was deprioritizing his partner, you know, so understanding origin wounds can tie some of that together. But the point I think that we're on right now is we are so good at distracting ourselves away from the pain. So even if it's harder for us to identify what the wound is, I was just in my book club and I was talking about the path of how we cover or conceal our wounds. And some of it is where we have a hard time identifying what the actual wound is. But sometimes in the big story, right, in the like, I know exactly what my pain is, I know exactly what my wounds are, one of the ways that we conceal or hide from it is because we get lost talking about the facts, talking about the bigness of it, right? We're in the storytelling of our pain, which becomes a distraction away from actually connecting to our pain.
Goodness. Yeah.
So there's a number of ways in which we can kind of move away from actually acknowledging, kind of getting like into the tender spots of what our actual pain is. And yeah. I know it's hard work. And I know sometimes we get scared. I think especially I was just talking to somebody on another show about the high achievers, like, no trauma, no pain, like got to keep going. This is, you know, this is the driver. This is the motivating force.
Nobody got time for that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's going to make me lose my edge. I'm going to, you know, lose track. I'm not going to be able to move forward. And again, to identify what our fears are, what our insecurities are about moving into this work is really important.
And I want to get into how we conceal, because that's where I am going to, that's where I need to dig in on my own work. But I get the chance to talk to you about it first. I do want to, I mean, we're 20 minutes in right now, and the honest to God thing that really hooked me in your book was just, and again, I think this was right at the beginning, but it was the you had me right there, was the aspect of acceptance, attachment over authenticity. To me, it felt like, oh my gosh, this is the biggest ball of wax right here. And I think what hit me, Vienna, is just realizing that we can't not. So set up the premise. You're saying, as kids, as in our upbringing, we are going to pursue acceptance, affirmation, all the A's, all these things. Attachment is what we're going to pursue that above our own authenticity, and we really can't not. That is just basic humanity. But then when that becomes a habit, which it kind of has to at that point, then we find ourselves at whatever age, whether it's 10 or 20 or 30, and we don't really know how to be authentic. And that's honestly my story, Vienna, of realizing I embraced some aspects of performance and people pleasing, and I don't, it's hard for me to bring up some great trauma, but I just found out, man, if I do that, I make people happy. You know, I get what I want, if nothing else. Maybe it was selfish to some degree even, but I embraced that to the point, and until I came to a point of burnout and realized, oh my gosh, I don't even know what authentic to myself looks like. And that's a big question I want to ask you, but let's go back to that. Just your
share that aspect of that reality of what you're saying is we all by proxy in our upbringing with that operating system, we are going to gravitate towards seeking attachment, and that is going to eclipse us being authentic. And from that, it feels like it's pretty common that you're not even going to know what your authentic self is, much less how to operate in it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's certainly circumstances where we might have a family system where authenticity is welcomed and there doesn't need to be that trade. But I think that there are probably more environments in which, you know, I say these are our lifelines, authenticity and attachment when we're kiddos. And Dr. Gabor Mate talks about how if it is attachment that is threatened, authenticity has to be traded, right? And so this idea of like, you know, when we're tiny little humans in the world, like to be myself, to honor that means that I lose you, or to be connected to you means that I have to lose myself. Right? And that happens far too often. I wouldn't say that it happens to every single person, but it happens far too often, right? To believe that I need to exit who I am in order to stay connected to you, because we need that as kids. That's our survival. Of course we do. Of course we choose attachment over authenticity. We want to be accepted. We want to be loved. We want to be safe. We want to be taken care of, right? Our need for survival exists there. And it is in that space, though, where I say in the book that we learn to, you know, self-betray. It's where we learn to self-abandon, and it becomes the way of existing in the world. To your point, right? It's like you became a, you know, pleaser or a performer or a perfectionist. You know, it's like I became easygoing and needless.
I thought, and I'm struggling not to continue thinking, this is what I have to break. I felt valiant in it, Vienna. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I felt that and just take, man, I can take what I had a friend say that, dude, you just take whatever anybody dishes out and you just don't react. You can just, you know, like, and he kind of meant it as a compliment maybe, but when I heard it, I thought, oh, because as I'm growing into this, you know, what's the authentic me? Self-betrayal was, I thought that was being, that's what you do. You take care of stuff. Mm-hmm. You don't let yourself get in the way, which may be good if you're in battle or something like that. But in intimate relationships, it didn't work. And I was at the cusp of realizing that.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't have to get deep into your story, but I know you were saying, I don't know that there's sort of this catalyst, this event in which I was required to do that. But it's what I want to offer here is that sometimes it's through experience in which this happens, but also sometimes it's through observation. You know, maybe you watched someone in your family system self-betray in some way or exist in an inauthentic way. And that became something that you wound up absorbing. Again, that might not be true for your story, but I think for any of the listeners who are like, well, but nobody ever forced me to do this or that. But yeah, but did you watch someone you loved live that way?
Well, and even the culture, as you were talking about attachment, Vienna, I started thinking about, and I don't want to piss off the wrong people that can actually kill me, but I literally started thinking about like military forces guys, you know, and all the manly stuff. And what is their mantra? Man, it is the core above all else. It is the team above all else. We don't think there's no emotions. There's no family. There's almost no God, man. It is just, I mean, and that desire for attachment that we applaud as a culture. I mean, so who knows how much of that a movie I saw or a TV show or a group of people in that kind of, and I looked at it and thought, yeah. And I grab onto that. And all of a sudden, man, there's no place for authenticity. You are about attachment. You are about belonging, which as you talk about is our core desire and how to belong and be authentic. Almost, I think for a lot of people hearing this right now, you can feel like that's impossible. You've got patients in front of you all the time that have got to feel like I have no file for that. Is that where you find a lot of our culture right now, even if they hear the message?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so scary because of what the fear of loss is, right? What the threat is to us. Because when you grow up, again, internalizing doesn't have to even mean that someone said it out loud to you or, you know, that you had some massive experience of it, but internalizing that I need to be this way, fill in the blank, whatever it is, right? in order to be safe, connected, close, validated, approved of, loved, accepted, whatever, right? The idea of now as adults stepping out and saying, okay, this is, but I actually disagree with you. Or, oh, this is actually how I'm feeling. You know, that was so hard for me to do. I was such a, you know, I shared this earlier. My parents divorce, so chaotic. I'm this fly under the radar, have no needs, pretend to be unaffected, pretend to be fine all of the time, because that's the best way to move through this scenario. And that made me into a needless woman who similarly was, you know, kind of existing in the cool girl persona, which meant, again, I had no needs. I was unaffected by things. Yeah, whatever you want to do, that's totally fine by me. Don't worry about me over here, right? And what happened with that meant that I was constantly boundaryless, right? I was constantly avoiding where the line was for me, where I had a preference, what was acceptable, what was respectful. I was in a relationship in mid late 20s, and the guy I was dating, I thought I was going to, I really saw a future with him. His ex came back into the picture, and he was trying to decide whether or not to go back into a relationship with her or to stay in the relationship with me. And boom, there it was. Oh my gosh, of course, take all the time you need. This must be so hard for you. Wow. Da, 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 right? Yeah, it's like, it's hard to say it out loud, even now, where you're like, oh, that's a bit cringy. You know, it's a bit hard. And yet, of course, I said that because I was so scared to say I was affected, to say that I didn't like something, to say that this didn't feel respectful, because what that meant was, no, there's no room for that. One, the other layer of it is that I alluded to this, there was, well, part of my worthiness wound generated from my dad when I was really easygoing, love, connection, help, support, all of that was really available to me. When I was difficult or I stepped out of line, quote unquote, AKA being a teenager, then I would be punished through silent treatment. And so that would go on for days or weeks sometimes. And I really learned, again, it was kind of restored there, that have no needs, don't step out, don't express yourself, right? Just be easygoing, pretend like things are fine, go along with what he says. That's how you get your attachment. And if you step out of that, then you lose connection, you know, you lose the relationship. Fast forward to what I was just saying about this partner at the time, I was like too threatening to say anything because the fear was, if I do, this will end. Yeah. I get to a point in it where I have this big aha moment of like, wow, I'm still in the role that I was in as a child going through that divorce. And I wind up calling and saying, hey, you know, I feel disrespected. This is actually not okay. I'm not okay with what's going on. And I'm going to remove myself from the scenario. My heart is beating out of my chest. My palms are sweating. You have to understand that for someone for decades who has never said, I'm not okay, that was a profound moment in my life to say, I'm not okay. I'm not good with what's going on here. And to take a stand for myself, right? To say like, no, there's a boundary that's being crossed. And, you know, that was it. Like, this was a huge catalyst for me where it's like, oh, it's okay to say this out loud. It's okay to be not okay, to say things that are not fine when they're not fine. And it's speaking to the authenticity, right? Is to be fully expressed in what is true and honest for you. And that's what that moment was for me, was really stepping into the authentic expression of what I was actually feeling. And knowing that authenticity, there's a risk, right? I think sometimes we want to kind of package it in some way where, okay, as long as the outcome is what I want it to be, you know, the outcome was that the relationship ended. The outcome was I never spoke to him again. That was the end of it. That was it, right? It's like, I had to be okay with an unwanted outcome. I had to be okay with leading with my authenticity being more important than trying to control an outcome.
I want to ask about that, but I do real quick though, on your story of being, you know, okay with not being okay, and some of those corrections, as you have, we use the term, you know, overcoming a lot. We have overcomers groups, and we understand that. I often struggle with that because the overcoming, I think we tend to think of as eradicating. So do you now say, okay, so now I'm aware of all this stuff and it just, I'm good. It all comes easy now. It's natural. I've totally reprogrammed myself. Or is it more of, no, now that I'm aware, I still tend to react very similarly, naturally, but I can real quickly or almost automatically get to the point of self-correction. Is that fair? Or do you feel like, okay.
Yeah, I would probably go more with the latter in that, yeah, with growth and healing and all these things, right? And in the quote unquote overcoming, it's a non-linear thing. I think once we set, when I talk about that story, I often talk, I don't know if you ever, like cross country skiing or not, but just sort of the idea, like when you're on fresh powder, it's got to work hard, right? And you're getting that track going. When there's a track there already for you, a lot easier, right? This is familiar. I know how to do this. I don't have to work as hard. That moment in me saying, I'm not okay. This feels disrespectful, right? Actually having an expression of authenticity for myself at that time was me jumping off the tracks and jumping into fresh powder. Right. And it was hard, but I set the track in motion, which meant it was a little bit easier as I continued on with it. Does it mean I never turn back? Absolutely not. Does it mean in all of this work that I'm like, I'm never activated and I'm never reactive and my old ways of being never present themselves? Of course not. They do. But to your point, we have a deeper awareness of it that you've heard of the, it's this pretty famous quote that's attributed to Viktor Frankl between stimulus and response, there is a pause, right? And in that pause is sort of this gateway to our freedom. That pause starts to extend. And why I talk about the extension of that pause, the pause gets a little bit longer, the more that we understand our family of origin. The pause gets a little bit longer, the more that we understand our origin wounding. The pause gets a little bit longer once we kind of connect to, oh, I see that the unresolved pain from my past is playing out in this way, right? So instead of just these automatic reactions, activations, behaviors, right, we actually get to hang out in that pause for a moment and say, okay, is what I'm about to say or do an extension of, let's just say, authenticity or inauthenticity? Is it an extension of where, like peace or suffering within the context of my healing and expansion goals, right? It's like, it's in that space where I get to bring my awareness, my self-reflection, and be at that point of going down the path that I know that's familiar, or like working a little bit harder, right? Kind of challenging this piece and being able to lean towards what my goals are.
Okay, I want to give people a couple resources right on that, because as you're talking about the Viktor Frankl quote and that middle point is, you know, that story that we, that meaning we attribute to something. And a lot of folks probably heard it, but if they didn't, we had Kendra Hall on the show, and her book, I think it was Change Your Story, Change Your Life, talks about that. And we just recently had Michael Hyatt on, and his is Mind Your Mindset. So if you want to go further into what Vienna just talked about, I mean, you talk about that in their book, in your book, but then they have a whole book about it to go deeper on there. Okay. Well, so you hit on, I mean, another bombshell of a topic to me then is defining authenticity. And Vienna, I've struggled with this. I struggle with how people perceive that, because I mean, I've been studying this for a long time. I've got you on here. I mean, I think I get the concept, and yet as a culture, I feel like it also gets lost somewhat in the, well, to paint the quick analogy, it's just can you just love me for who I am? Right. That kind of feeling people judge. Can I just, all the self-help stuff and all this, you know, behavior modification, can you just love me for who I am? And I'm thinking about my kids and my kid, I'm never not going to love my kid. Right now though, the kid may be being a little butt, and I don't really like your behavior. And I kind of feel like I don't even like who you're being right now. And I want to play with that a little bit, because I feel like people, we get lost in what really is being authentic, because there is a place for, well, I'll just ask you to play with that. There's a place for behavior modification that you go in, because if I'm just truly unfiltered, authentic, it could be like Tourette's syndrome. I mean, you do not want to hear every thought that comes out of my head in a conversation, in a relationship, because if it's unfiltered, a lot of times it could just be mean, it can be selfish. Mm-hmm. And there's that place like to do just what you talked about, to stop and go, okay, wait a minute, take a deep breath. You just heard something happened, you know, how are you going to react? And yet there's people that feel like, well, gosh, if I have to perform, then that's not being authentic. Mm-hmm. Play with that, because it feels like a tension that I don't feel a lot of us have a good grasp on how that really works to be authentic, but to also be sensitive to others.
Friends, I'm pretty candid about my lack of financial prowess. Money and numbers are fairly Greek to me, so I need a lot of guidance. One of my closest friends is a wildly successful wealth manager, and I'm working on some financial literacy and just continually seeking guidance. So I ask you to check out yahoofinance.com. Nobody knows it all, and Yahoo Finance is an incredible resource for the rookies like me or the seasoned investors. You know, before my dad passed away recently, Dave Ramsey and his wife Sharon flew down to visit. We all got to spend a day together. And I was at yahoofinance.com just now. I saw multiple news flashes from Dave and other people that you respect. And they're hitting so many of the hottest areas in finance today. So it's a place to get a snapshot of all aspects of your financial interests. And if you have them, your portfolios. I hadn't realized Yahoo Finance is the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. So for your comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. One more time. yahoofinance.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is the concept that love can be unconditional, but that relationships must have conditions in order for them to thrive.
Oh, say that again. I mean, that right there is a big statement. Say that again.
Yeah, love can be unconditional, but relationships must have conditions in order for them to thrive.
Goodness. Okay. That's a big statement.
And that's, to me, is the discerning line of what you're talking about, right? This idea of, yeah, of course I can love someone who I love, right? I will likely always love you, right? I mean, you spoke to your child, right? The parent-child relationship, which I think is, you know, one where most people are like, yes, of course, unconditional love, right. Unconditional love, right? But we can have unconditional love for other humans in our lives too. It's just that we must have conditions to the relationship, right? Otherwise people say, take me as I am or leave me with nothing, you know, or some like silly
exactly.
Meme.
Yes, exactly.
You know, that's, it's such a, I can't stand those quotes that I see sometimes circulating the internet. They're just like, if you can't love me at my worst, then you don't deserve me at my best. And it's like, no, that's a way to avoid doing the work that you need to do. You know, it's like, that's a distraction away. And it's, I understand the premise. I understand what people are saying. It's like in my darkest, right? In my challenging parts, you know, can you not just run the other direction? I get that. But it's just so much more nuanced. I have a story for you. In the beginning, before I was engaged to my now husband, I was in a conflict with Connor. I have no clue what the conflict was about. I couldn't tell you any details about it. Other than I could not stop proving my point. I could not stop the need to be right. And I was going. He's like, I got it. Yeah, yeah, I understand. I'm going again, doubling down. He's like, babe, I got it. I understand what you're saying. Going again, tripling down. I just couldn't shut up. I just kept going. I needed to be right. And I had this out-of-body moment in it, where I like see myself behaving this way. And I'm like if that part could speak, it would have been like, please stop talking, like take it back, pull it back in, reel it in, you know, please quit. This is not, you know, an attractive way of existing in the world. Couldn't stop. And then eventually, finally, it ends. And I remember feeling a lot of shame and embarrassment. And Connor actually, you know, what struck me in it was how grounded he was and how much I still felt loved by him. Hmm. He was not into the behavior for sure, but I didn't feel him waver in terms of, I love you and I care about you and I'm here and I'm not going anywhere. Those words weren't spoken, but I felt that. And I remember thinking, okay, shame, embarrassment. And then if I'm being really honest, was like, yeah, yikes. Like, I wonder if this guy is going to want to stay with me. And certainly if I keep behaving this way, this is not a great recipe, right? And so instead of staying in the shame and the embarrassment, though, I got very curious about, like, what does needing to be right and proving my point serve? And so this is kind of a two-part process of, to our point about there needing to be conditions to relationships, right? It's like, no, that behavior does not get to just exist and persist, and I have to pretend as if that's not going to damage the quality of my relationship at some point. Yeah. Of course it will. And of course, then it's like, oh no, that's outside of the conditions for us to have a thriving partnership. You can't just keep doing that. But instead of just like, okay, well then screw you or cut the cord and we're out of here, there was a curiosity. Okay, what does this behavior serve? Because spoiler alert, our behavior serves things, even when it's dysfunctional stuff. And what I was able to connect to, and I shared this already about my story, was that I grew up with manipulation, gaslighting in my family system, not directed at me, but I watched it. It was very crazy making for my mom. And from a really early age, I understood that unless I track things, unless I am quite literally right about the details, I am unsafe. If I'm right, I'm safe. If I'm not right, I'm unsafe.
Right.
And that was, again, such a profound kind of aha light bulb moment for me to be like, okay, makes a lot of sense why this part gets activated in a conflict. Like I said, had no clue what the conflict was about, but the need to be right and prove my point was my way of creating safety for myself. Now, okay, behavior makes a whole heck of a lot of sense when you understand my history, and my family system, and my origin stories, but fast forward, guess what, Vienna? You can't just behave that way in partnership with this person who is not manipulating you, who is not gaslighting, who is not, you know, creating any type of unsafe environment for you. And I had to shift from like this shift into the mature, wise adult experience, right? Is, you know, obviously it takes work and we earn it and all of that, but there is something about being able to reflect on the things that we do that are disconnectors, right? The things that we do, right? How we contribute to whatever the relationships are, whether it's partnership, whether it's our own children, whether it's our own parents in this, you know, later chapter of life, whether it's our friends, our colleagues, strangers on the street, whatever it might be, right? To see the ways in which we are contributing to the disconnection, the demise, the dysfunction of the dynamic.
I think I was looking at your Facebook, or I'm sorry, your Instagram feed, which I'll probably say this in the intro, but you've got, I don't know, 700, 800,000 people on there, something like that. And I also saw one, I've got Terry Real on the feed, cause he was on the show, and he, a couple of his posts today were about the wise adult as opposed to, I think he says the maladaptive child. Does that sound right? Yeah.
And that, that sounds right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That I'm showing up as, because as you're sitting there talking and telling the story, I'm thinking about, it's so easy to think about on the condition. And I'm going to say your quote again, love can be unconditional, but relationships must have conditions in order to survive. And I'm thinking of a little kid, you know, on the playground, and somebody does something, maybe it's not super nice, and they hit, and you come over and go, okay, Sally, you know, it's, if you're doing a good job, I guess you would validate, hey, I'm sure what, you know, what Barbara did was upsetting to you, but you just, we can't hit. We can't hit. That's something. And even if you are, like you were talking to Ishar, even if you were being gaslighted or manipulated or whatever, you still don't, it's still not socially acceptable to hit, but there's something in there where we still missed it or we tend to, because we'll tend to come over to the kid and just say, hey, you just be nice. Just be nice. Just curb it, can it, whatever, just be nice. And we're not. And is that where we go wrong? Because we're not validating the kid's feelings or our own feelings, even though you can't do that behavior. So how do we, feels like that's what you're saying. How do we be authentic to ourselves and validate and and work within those feelings and yet still realize that if we're going to be in a relationship, though, we don't just unfiltered.
But, you know, but people are saying that this is my authentic self, except it's generated from their pain. You know,
this is my authentic wounded self. And you're saying, no, well, you can be authentic in your what?
Well, because that quote, right, that we're circling around is like, if you loved me enough, you would just, right, fill in the blank. You wouldn't leave me. Well, if you loved me enough, my infidelity wouldn't push you away. If you loved me enough, me being emotionally abusive wouldn't be enough for you to go, you know, right? Like, and I know these are very significant examples, of course, and yet we know that people say those types of things. Or, you know, if you loved me, you wouldn't leave me just because I will not face my addiction. If you love me, you will not do this because of that, right? Like, that is something that is often communicated, whether it's explicitly stated or whether it's implied by the other person. And again, to that quote that we keep coming back to, right, where it's like, well, this is who I am. Well, okay, maybe, maybe, yes, this is who you are in this moment. But essentially what you're saying is, I'm not going to touch any of my irresolution. And because relationships ought to be unconditional, because that would be the premise, right? Is that not just love, right? The relationship ought to be unconditional. I don't have to do anything about my irresolution. And you need to love me anyway. You need to choose me anyway. You need to stay with me anyway. And so love me anyway, maybe, sure. I think we all love people who maybe are not going to face certain things, or they're not going to change up something. I still love you, okay? But here's how I'm going to navigate this relationship with you, knowing that that's not something that you're going to shift or change, okay? Right. But this idea that, especially in intimate relationships, right, this idea that, nope, this is my authentic self, right, is, again, it's the blocker, you know, it's why relationships will keep ending, right? It's why, you know, people can't actually get closer to you, right? I think authenticity is on the other side of resolution.
Yeah. You got me again, thinking about, yeah, we want to be, as that cry to be unfiltered, makes me think there was a movie, it's a popular movie, and they're on this planet, and whatever the men think is, it comes out audibly. Whatever they think comes out audibly. It's kind of, you know, kind of funny, but it was an action adventure kind of thing. And that'd be terrible. Like, again, I mean, the thoughts that, and we can get into, you know, a spiritual aspect or whatnot there, but I mean, we have some crazy thoughts that go on our head, especially in our culture where we see everything. And I'm aware that sometimes, man, some of the most vile thought will just kind of run through my head. And I had a guy one time tell me, man, you can't just crucify yourself for that. You're just, hopefully you don't take action, you know, on that, but we don't want that to come through. And your statement of, you got me thinking about being unresolved, of the unresolved things. And when I'm acting out of that, that's not, maybe it's authentic, but it's not whole. It's not healthy. It's not helpful. That's okay. And the other statement that you said in this segment of the book that really got me, and I don't know that I can even unpack it well enough, so I'll take advantage of having you here now. You said, this may be my paraphrasing. So when you get the validation, so when you are not being authentic and you're just externally trying to, you know, manage other people's emotions and deal with that, and you get the validation and affirmation and acceptance by performing from these folks, now you don't trust yourself, or, and this is what got me, or the person you're getting the validation from. And so I'm thinking, great, I just sabotaged both of us. I just screwed me and I screwed you in the relationship, because say that in a way, because that was my notes of paraphrasing. I should have pulled out what you said, but in essence, if you're not being, you know, healthfully authentic to yourself, and you're just people pleasing and performing and trying to make people happy out here, you are sabotaging yourself. You're not being authentic to yourself, and now you don't trust them because their reaction to you, you know, is based on a lie. In essence, well, that sucks. That's just terrible. That's a really crappy. It felt like that's really enlightening. Honestly, Vienna, is what I thought.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I think you did a great job summarizing it. In essence, take a little bit further that when you have to perform, please, fake it in some way in order to get the love, the connection, the validation, the approval, and that you then get it, your system still knows that it's not real,
yes,
right? That because you got what you wanted, sure, but you got it by being someone other than who you are.
That's harsh. Your system knows it's not real. I mean,
Ben, yeah, your system knows what's up.
We could spend the next 2 hours talking about myself. This has been who I chose to be, and I was in pretty much every relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think it's why I struggle with the trust issues. Okay, I want to give this whole conversation not a caveat, but a premise here, because this is really, I think it's chapter two of the book that, you know, you came to this book, you came to this topic, The Origins of You, because your patients, like me, you know, we come in, we got a problem. Marriage is in trouble. I'm feeling depressed. I'm whatever. Can you fix what's happening right now? And we're looking forward. And you, I think you shared in the book, one patient like, oh, great, you're going to make me go back into the past like all the therapists do. And you're like, yes. And so if we come back to, yes, you are behaving from the unresolution in your past, from the operating system that you were given. I was thinking about my kids. They have Miller 1.0. Sorry, guys. I mean, that's what I mean, for better and worse, there's good and bad, but they've got that. And if you're going to fix what's happening now, it is a result of what you've been doing in the past. And again, I appreciate you saying it's not to go vilify your parents or your caregivers or whatever, but even if they were the best people on planet Earth, they were limited. They were ignorant. They were, they only knew what they
unresolved
knew.
Unresolved.
Yeah. They couldn't be perfectly healthy, and you're part of that. So as we all look at the things that we're struggling with right now, you're saying, man, looking forward is, well, I guess you would say that's symptomatic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as I say too, like, cool, look forward. Let's see, like, try it. You know, I don't mind trying it. Right. And I think that there are certain things that we might be able to change just like that, because we decide to get really disciplined with something and we can make that behavioral change, and beautiful. Okay. So if that's there, fine. We don't need to look back. Okay. But if you keep coming back, which, spoiler alert, I kind of think that's all of us.
I'll vote. You got my testimony. Right. Yeah.
Right. So I'm like, I'm fine for you to say, nope, I can make this change. All right, cool. Let's see. I'll see you back here in, you know, a few months, and we'll dive in a little bit differently. And yeah, you're right. I speak to this in that first story that I share outside of my own with Natasha. Where she's like, I'm trying to decide whether I want to stay with my partner, Clyde. We're about to get engaged. Yep. You know, what should I? I just have this icky feeling that the other shoe is going to drop at some point. And I'm like, okay, well, great. Did the other shoe drop in past relationships, in your family of origin? And exactly as you said, why do therapists always need to go back there? Like, I'm focused on this. You're not going to find anything there. I had a perfect childhood, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, right, there's this opening that happens. And she shares with me a story about when she was a teenager, she had to use her dad's computer, and he had said yes, but there was an email open.
Yes,
and she stumbled upon a email thread between her father and a woman who wasn't her mother that was expressing all about love and how great the weekends were and can't wait to see you again and all of this. And it just shattered her image. Yeah. He walks in on her. He sees her with tears in her eyes, says, I promise I'll cut it off, but please don't tell your mother. She never tells her mother. The way in which she copes with it is by going on and absorbing this betrayal and placing it somewhere inside of her, but far away, because she's had to deny it, and she's had to hide it, and she's had to really forget it in order for the family system to go on as it was before. And so it actually makes quite a bit of sense why it was hard for her to even name that there was another shoe that had dropped in her family of origin. This was the first time that she had shared it with anybody. was to me. And because you understood that it was almost gone from her because she had hidden it for so long, so well, but it cracked it open to see that that unresolved pain, right? The fact that there was this betrayal, the fact that she had held her father on a pedestal, this man who would come home from work, have meals with his family, seemingly was happy, loved the family, all this shattered her image of him, was dictating this storyline that the other shoe was going to drop in all of her relationships. And the way that she dealt with it prior to this relationship was that she would prematurely exit those relationships. Maybe she'd sabotage something, but she'd find a way to exit and, you know, cut the connection and the intimacy and all of that until this. And so it required us to tend to the unresolved pain, the origin wound around trust for her, so that she could actually get into that wise, mature adult space to choose a path forward with him. And, you know, I think it's to the point that both of us are making is that there is stuff in our past and childhood. Okay, it could be 4, 5, 6. It could be 14. It could be, you know, it's like it can happen anywhere. And sometimes origin stories happened 2 weeks ago, right? It's possible.
I want to hit that, Vienna, because something that I had never considered before reading your book was in that. And so in looking kind of back to the wounds kind of thing, mm-hmm. and looking at those origins, I tend to think of the ongoing things. So we're all looking back and going, okay, ongoing day to day, week to week, month to month, years go by, you know, what were those things that happened and that programmed us and whatever. And then, but you talked about, and I didn't note where this was in the book, but in essence, how profound firsts are, things that happen. And I thought, holy smokes, how often do we talk about that event that happened? It was the first day of school, first day in a new school, the first day at college, first day at the job, first day going out to football tryouts, the first, those first where we are in an emotionally sensitive place. We're probably got some fear, some insecurity. And then especially if something, well, you could probably say good or bad. If you were dramatically applauded, that it kind of set, holy smokes, this is everything. And maybe you went after something and that became your self-image and it shouldn't have. And that was, you know, on a seemingly good note. Or on the other side where it was tragic and it was just a moment. And I think about some of those. Yeah, then I've had some of those in my adulthood that were first, that were so significant. So again, going back and trying to connect with some of the wounds that cause unresolution that then cause the patterns, that they could be, it happened from one moment and it programmed you. And yeah, as you said, it might have happened at 5. It might have happened at 35. And I have not taken that into account. I read that, I think it was yesterday, that section. Uh-huh. And I thought, dang, there's another audit I need to do. Let me go back and think about some of the firsts in my life, first child, first whatever, and think about what's going on there. What do I have?
Yeah, those first, and then the first time that you didn't feel good enough, the first time you didn't feel like you belonged, right? You share a story of a client of mine where he had shared that at some point in middle school, the girl he liked, he had heard that she said that she would have liked him if he were taller.
Oh.
That's it. Wow. Period. And that alone, right, was dictating his sense of worthiness. He'd go on to be someone who needed to become friends with women before he would date them, so that there was more like investment, because otherwise his height didn't feel, you know, was so significant in his mind, right? So that like, if we're more invested, then maybe you will overlook this. Right. And it traces, right? It's like, here's this like, kind of throwaway comment in middle school. But no, it's actually not, right? Because here's this thing that pierces us in a particular way and then somehow comes along with us in ways that maybe we're not even aware of. Like, oh, yeah, like I'm recalling that thing. You know, it's like, if we're not, to your point, taking those audits enough to be like, hang on, you know, like what put my worth into question? You know, how was I valuable to the people around me? Right? Was I valuable when I was the comic relief? Was I valuable when I was helping mom when she was sad? Right? Was I valuable when I was a phenomenal athlete and that's what made mom happy? You know, it's like to really look closely at those things that maybe we haven't looked at.
You just said the word worth, and literally part two of your book starts off with that. And I was very impacted by some of the questions that you put in the book. That was one of them, in the aspect of self-worth, which has been somewhat of a thread here on the shows as of late, talking about that. And it has for me personally, which is why it is on the show, because I get to talk about what I want or what I need, I should say. And that aspect of worth, the question that you had, I think you had a patient setting or something like that, a group setting, or maybe it was what you were asking individual patients to finish a sentence. I'm unworthy because, and just sit and you had people shouting out stuff, and it's all these insecurities that I have not met a human yet who does not have an insecurity, and really who does not have one that you can kind of see. We can all see each other. So that'd be a great one to ask our friends to feel that. Hey, I should ask my buddies, you know, hey, Randy, so finish the sentence as of me. Kevin's unworthy because, and say what you would, he would give a list. My wife would give a list. Some of my kids would probably give a list, and they see my insecurities. We think we're hiding them, which is part of your, actually that I think that's before part two in your book. And you have a list of the ways that we conceal and then the cost of concealing. And again, that's why you're on the show. We're talking about it, but I got some work to do to dig into those and how we're concealing and the cost of concealing. And I was thinking that people see my people who know me, they know what I'm doing. They know my insecurities. They know how I'm concealing it. I'm not fooling anybody but myself. And so to answer that question, I'm unworthy because feels well, life changing, which I guess is what you see with your patients.
Yeah. Do you know how you'd answer it?
I'm unworthy because it would feed into perfection. I try to earn my worth by the things that I do. I'm unworthy because, well, what I know to say now, I wouldn't have in the past, is I naturally, okay, this is just my admission. I'm unworthy because I'm not limitless. Because sometimes there are relevant excuses, which I don't even like the word. I mean, it's a counseling session here. You can invoice.
Thank you for letting me flip the script for a second, because I think it's, you know, it is so powerful. And I think for the high achievers and the perfectionists and those who, you know, maybe have found a way to, you know, accomplish, quite a bit in their lives.
I'm unworthy because I haven't, even though I spent probably longer preparing for this interview with you than most anybody that you're going to talk with, which I think is why people listen to the show, but I still show up and kind of feel like an imposter, even though I know we're going to turn the thing on and we're going to do a show and we're going to do a great show and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are going to listen to it. I still show up feeling like I haven't done enough. Cause that's part of my, it was part of my life as a pro cyclist. I haven't done as much as the other. I'm not prepared enough. So I'm going to have to suffer more. So yeah, again, back into the,
There it is. It's so good.
It is, it can
to
be good.
Acknowledge it. Yeah. To acknowledge it that way.
Yeah. And then it's doing the work of it. And then, which is, isn't that the title of, I think one of the ending points of your book, well, I have to pull the contents up here, is then, and that's where I was actually reading this morning, is how to take all this and make it stick. Your reclamation is what you titled the last part of it, is making it stick. Vienna, I do want to hit a big thing. So I come from a heavily religious background. I'm not going to, but I think this is something that has infiltrated our entire culture, at least in America, and I think beyond that. And I'm actually going to pull out a scripture because it's so invasive, which sounds like a bad term, but it's in Matthew. So in the Bible, book of Matthew 22:37-40, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I grew up with that statement. And it wasn't just like preached from my parents or whatever, but that was the context of the South, the Bible Belt, the church, mm-hmm. the Christianity that I grew up in. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Vienna, nobody ever mm-hmm. talked about how you love yourself. Mm-hmm. Didn't exist. And so I think the whole effort was a performance for most, mm-hmm. for me, for most of us, it's a performance to go out, love others as I love myself. I don't love myself. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I don't even know who the hell I am. And mm-hmm. I'm supposed to go love. And so I'm trying, I'm pouring out of a broken, cracked cup here. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, we are a nation that's, you know, founded on a lot of that religion. And I'm sure I'm not pointing anything at the religion. That's a great line that we don't know how to translate, it feels like. And it feels like that's at the crux here.
Yeah. I mean, when you read it, the first thing I thought was, well, if you hate yourself, then you're going to hate others, right? And, you know, to your point, like, what does it look like to love and accept ourselves, right? To actually know how to be with ourselves, right? I love, but the notion's so powerful to, I kind of hear it as, and probably unsurprisingly, right? I to see ourselves, to remember to see others, you know, in the way in which we are seeing ourselves, which kind of points to one of the parts at the end of the book where I share an exercise from Michael Kerr, who's a psychotherapist and researcher, author. He says to try this, to think of your mother as your grandmother's daughter, and see what changes, right? To see how that perspective shifts. And so when you say to love yourself, to love thy neighbor in the way that you love yourself, right? It's like that lens of, we all are, we're tiny little humans in flawed and imperfect systems. And if you can remember that about your neighbor, you know, what shifts? If you can remember that about yourself, what shifts? If you can remember that about the people you care about, what shifts? And, but to your point, right, this concept of what, you know, what is self-love? It's like, I think self-love is the intersection of compassion and grace for the self, meaning like the human experience that we are flawed and imperfect, with accountability and ownership.
Compassion and grace with accountability and ownership. It reminds me of Tom Ziegler, who often co-hosts with me, his statement of having the highest standards and the deepest grace for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We must, right? Because one without the other is, you know, it doesn't work that way, right? To love ourselves well means that we can hold the grace and compassion for ourselves that's needed for every human on this planet, while also making sure that accountability and ownership are intersecting with that. Because we can't just be like, oh, I'm a human, sorry, right? And we can't just be like, oh, I'm the worst, you know, and I have to be accountable and never offer ourselves the space to be seen as this imperfect, flawed human existing in these systems. And I think when we get pretty good at those pieces intersecting, that's where, you know, love for the self can happen. Because I think love gets generated from seeing ourselves do things differently and operate in the world and in relationships in a way in which we can hold our head up high. And that doesn't mean that we don't have history and stories where maybe we hang our heads. Of course we do, right? There's things we look back and you're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I did that. Or I said that, I was so immature. Yes. You know, my insecurity was in the driver's seat. That's every single person's story. Of course it is, right? But to be able to pick that head up, right, to hold it up, to believe and to exist in the world where you're like, I'm proud of myself, right? Like, I'll make mistakes. I'll continue to make mistakes, but I will look at those mistakes. I'll find a way to own them. It might take me a couple weeks, a couple days, maybe a couple months, right? For some, maybe years, right? But like, I'm committed to that. And that, I think, is where love for the self can bud.
I've got other questions, and they're going to be a great fit in part two. We talked, I just brought us into some spiritual aspects. I've got a parenting question for you, but it's going to be a great fit for part two. Vienna, this is a top shelf book for me. I'm grateful that I got to dig into it now for us to talk through it. And now I'm eager to dig in because I've got some pieces that I want to understand more that I wasn't aware of. So thank you. Thank you for what you've done, for doing the work to bring this book to light and this message out. I'm a grateful recipient, and I'm really proud to bring this to the audience. Thank you. All right, friends, I'd say we have some discovery to do. And I'll tell you, Vienna's book is worth the purchase solely for the questions you'll find on page 35 to audit your background of attachment in your upbringing. It's just profound. I'm working through it right now. Again, the book is called The Origins of You, How Breaking Family Patterns Can Liberate the Way We Live and Love. And you can find Vienna at viennafarron.com, viennapharaon.com. Thank you so much for tuning into this self-helpful podcast where I strive to help you and me elevate our personal experience of life and the way we show up for others. Stay driven, my friends.